in this broader series of lectures, we're considering the history of Christianity up to about the year 1500 AD. And in this specific section of lectures, we're considering what's sometimes called the later medieval period. I speak of it in terms of being a broad period of the Christian empire from approximately 312, the conversion of Constantine, to about 1500. And I divide that into an earlier and a later period. So what we want to speak about in today's lecture is Christian life and Christian thinking in the later medieval period. And of course, as is true with everything in this overview of church history, we're just going to touch on a few items, and very lightly, actually. Any one of these things that we're going to talk about has been and could be the source of a great, great in-depth explanation and study. But this is a survey of church history. So let's talk about Christian life and thought in the later medieval period. The first thing I'd like to say about daily life in the later Christian Empire period is that life was hard, but it wasn't as hard as the early period of the Christian Empire. That period, approximately, let's just say 500 to 1000, you know, after the fall of the Roman Empire in the West, up to about the year 1000, it's sometimes known as the Dark Ages. Now, that's somewhat of a judgmental term, to be sure. But this later period is sometimes known as the High Middle Ages. And through this period, there was a slow, somewhat constant development of trade and a merchant class, a collection of cities and merchants known as the Hanseatic League was an important example of this development. And prominent families arose that were not nobility. In other words, they weren't of aristocracy in their genetics. They didn't descend from a royal line, but they were successful merchants and bankers and made their way through society in that way. They established themselves as powerful people to be reckoned with, both themselves and their families. So life was hard, but it was on a track of slow progress and development. That's number one. Number two, I think this is an important feature. People really believed in heaven and hell. It's very difficult for us to relate this to our modern thinking. Because for well more than 100 years, our society has done its best to erase any sense that men or women owe anything to God. But man hasn't always thought that way, and they haven't always thought that way in the West, in Europe, and later these children of Europe, so to speak, settlements in North America. There was a time when almost everyone in the Western world believed that heaven and hell were real, and that there was nothing more important in life than escaping hell and going to heaven. There's a wonderful book that I read some years ago by an author named Barbara Tuchman. It's titled A Distant Mirror, The Calamitous 14th Century. She writes in that book about life in Europe in the 14th century. And Barbara Tuchman in that book describes how when they were not fighting wars, unemployed soldiers became small armies of bandits, and they robbed and burned and killed and raped in many of the towns and villages all over Europe. Now, that book described how often these brutal criminals would negotiate with a town before they attacked it. If the town agreed to give these brutes a large amount of money, then the army would leave the city alone. But if the town refused to give the money, or they could not give the money, then they attacked. And these negotiations were done with formal contracts and, you know, just protocols and such. Now, from one such contract that we have existing to this day, they've discovered that when these horrible men came to a community that was a monastery, they insisted on money. Okay, you have to give us so much money. But they also demanded that the priests of the monastery give them a written document saying that all their sins were forgiven. Now, can you imagine that scene? These were violent, horrible, brutish men, yet they were concerned about the forgiveness of their sins and that they would go to heaven. They were concerned because they believed that heaven and hell were real. That's something very different about culture today, at least in the Western world, than it is in from several centuries ago, from this late medieval period. Number three, there was a great sublimation, if I can use that word. It just means a bringing under of the individual. The I, the individual, the ego, if you want to use a psychological term. That was brought under the interests of the community and under the interests of God and His glory as a whole. I'll give you an example of this. Canterbury Cathedral took 23 generations to build. And we don't even know the names or the architects or the builders. This was typical. You see, in this late medieval period, noblemen, aristocrats, they had surnames, they had second names, last names. But for more than 99% of medieval Europe, some 60 million people, they were simply known by a first name, as being the son of their parents, or by a nickname. There just wasn't much individuality. And people didn't demand, I'll do things if I can be known in doing it. There was a sense that the community was more important and, in some sense, that the glory of God was more important. Fourth, we can say, there was very little awareness of time in the sense of knowing what century you were in. Now, again, we have clocks, we have phones that tell us what time it is. We have calendars, we have reminders. We live with a very heavy consciousness of time. Even when we're late, we understand what time is. But in this late medieval period, people really didn't know what century they were in, what year they were in. Now, it's not that they were ignorant. It's just that these concepts weren't so important to them. But because things changed in society very slowly. Now, I just want you to think, here we are, the year I'm recording this lecture is the year 2022. And I just want you to think how different the world was 22 years ago at the year 2000. The world is very different today than it was just 22 years ago. There's been a lot of change. In some ways, there's been a lot of progress. But if you were to take life in the year 800 and then take a look at life in the year 1000 or compare the 200 years between 1300 and 1500, there was not nearly as much difference in the world. Now, as time went on, the closer you get to the year 1500, and we're just using that as an approximate sort of arbitrary marking point, the closer you got, there was more progress. And we'll talk a little bit about those things later. We have in previous lectures. There was great change coming upon the horizon. But in general, through this period, things changed very slowly. And the life you lived today was not greatly different than the life of the people who lived 200 years before you. The ecology of Europe was very different as well. If you were to go to Europe today, you'll see great fields and forests, of course, in traveling by train or driving, or if you were to fly, you'll notice there's a lot of empty space. But it was nothing what it was like, let's say, in the year 1000. I think I remember Barbara Tuchman saying in her book, which speaks about the 14th century, the 1300s, she said that you could walk from Poland to France, walking for 2 months straight and never see the sun because you were under constant forest. Now, look, we know Europe isn't like that now. It doesn't have these things that for hundreds and hundreds of kilometers, there's continual forest. There are certainly larger sections of forest, especially in mountains and such. But it was a different world back then in terms of just the ecology. Number six, I'll say that the Roman Catholic Church in Europe dominated life. The church was the wealthiest landowner in Europe, and it had huge influence over just the way people lived daily. If you were to eat meat during Lent at certain times in some places, that was considered to be a death penalty crime. To go against the authority of the church meant that the church said you were certainly going to hell. The doctrine was very simple in one sense. It was the doctrine of outside the church, there is no salvation. In Latin, it goes something like this, nulla salus extra ecclesiam. Now, that was first promoted as early as the 3rd century by Cyprian. But it was believed by almost everyone in Europe in this medieval period, and it was very explicitly affirmed by church councils. There is no salvation outside the church. Therefore, whatever the church tells you, you must do, you must actually do it. That's why you could say that by the 1200s, this is my point number seven, by the 1200s, virtually all Christians were members of a geographically defined parish, each with its own priest or pastor. In 15th century England, there were about 9,500 parishes with a population of about 3 million people. And so there was an average of roughly 300 men, women, and children for every parish. So there was time enough for the Christian institutions in Europe. We're mainly talking about the Roman Catholic Church. We're not talking about Christianity more in the East. That would be the Eastern Orthodox Church under its various branches. But in the West, under the Roman Catholic Church, there was time to develop a very sophisticated parish system based on geography. It's also interesting, at least to me, and this will be my 8th point, that astrology was used to explain things. For example, the University of Paris concluded, and this is a university, supposed scholars and researchers, the University of Paris concluded that the bubonic plague of the 1340s to 1350s was due to the coming together of Saturn, Jupiter, and Mars. The alignment of those planets is what resulted in the bubonic plague. Again, we look at that and think it's foolishness, but that kind of thinking was very strong in these Middle Ages. And in addition to prayers to the Trinity and to Jesus, medieval people prayed to the saints. They prayed to Mary. In some instances, this moved into the worship of the saints. It was common for them to spend more time at a shrine to Mary than at their parish church. So in many ways, the worship or the veneration of Mary and the saints became more of a focus than the worship and the veneration of God, and specifically the Messiah, Jesus Christ. Now, let me speak for a little while on the concept of purgatory and salvation. This was a factor in the thinking of the medieval Roman Catholic Church. You see, in Roman Catholic theology and practice, grace for salvation is received through the church. It's God's grace. They would make no claims about it. You are saved by the grace of God. It's just that that grace is received through the church. And the church is conceived, this may not be a great analogy, but I think it somewhat fits. The church is conceived as sort of a bank of grace, you know, like a bank where you save money. Jesus, Mary, and all the saints deposit grace into this bank of the church. The priest is like the teller at the bank of grace. He stands at the counter and distributes grace at the bank of grace, and you make withdrawals, you receive money from the bank of grace through the sacraments. Now, there are seven sacraments that in Roman Catholic thinking are the means or the method of bringing grace to men and women. These sacraments or means of grace are baptism, Holy Communion, confession, confirmation, holy matrimony, that's marriage, holy orders, that's ordination, the priesthood, and then finally, last rites. If a person receives the grace of God through the church by these sacraments, then their salvation is assured. It's sort of a very neat package. You can tell if someone's saved. You can know that you yourself are saved. And again, I'm talking about the Roman Catholic conception of this, especially in the Middle Ages. Their thinking was, you're saved by receiving God's grace. God's grace comes to you through the church. The church distributes grace through the sacraments. If you receive the sacraments, you've received God's grace, you're going to heaven. Now, one potential problem with this system is that it is possible to see people who receive all the sacraments they can, yet others can see that their life isn't holy or honoring to God. You could just imagine this kind of situation. Here's Brother Jones in the community. And Brother Jones has been baptized as a baby. He was confirmed. He's received Holy Communion. He goes to confession at least once a year. He was married by a priest. That's holy matrimony. And when he dies, a priest is there to pronounce last rites. He has six of the seven sacraments. According to Roman Catholic theology, that man is going to heaven. But if you look at the life of Brother Jones, this hypothetical example, he's a terrible man. He beats his wife and his children. He's unfaithful to his wife. He cheats at business. He's cruel to other people. He curses, he swears. I mean, I could go on and on. He's a drunkard, whatever. You just understand. This hypothetical man is a terrible man. Now, how do you square those two? He's received the sacraments, therefore the grace that promises he'll go to heaven. But this seems to be an impure, unchanged man. Now, one of the ways, I won't say that it's the only way because I don't know enough about Roman Catholic theology to say that it's the only way. But one of the ways that Roman Catholics have reconciled this is with the idea of purgatory. Purgatory is thought to be the place where the believing dead go after death, but before heaven. There in purgatory, the fires of purification burn away their unholiness, and they are made ready for heaven. Now, purgatory is unpleasant. It's even torture. But it is the necessary work to get Brother Jones to heaven. Now, if I could say, and I respect that Roman Catholics would disagree with me on this, but I'm speaking to you from my knowledge of the Bible, and as a Protestant, I would say confidently, this isn't anywhere in the Bible. But especially in the medieval period, it was an important part of Roman Catholic theology and practice. Therefore, some Christians who had died in God's grace because they received the sacraments, they were still burdened with unforgiven sins and unfulfilled penances. They needed to be cleansed. And people in purgatory can no longer help themselves, and they might remain in that purging fire for decades or even centuries, unimaginably long periods. Now, medieval Christians had a very strong sense of what you could say was solidarity or partnership or community, and they believed that they could and that they should help one another even across the grave. Therefore, one person's prayers, alms, or good deeds could literally be donated to another person, including those in purgatory. Those who were concerned about their dead parents, their spouses, their children, or others, they would pray for them, asking God to be merciful and to shorten their time of purgation, their time in purgatory. Through prayers, through good works, through pilgrimages, through donations to the church, you could also have the Pope free someone from purgatory. You see, it's very important to Roman Catholic theology to say that the Pope holds the keys to open all things in heaven and on earth. And therefore, because he has the keys, he can open things in heaven, on earth, he can free souls from purgatory if he chooses to. A church decree of 1343 explained some of this. This is the church decree Corpus Luris Canonici. Here's some of that decree. Now, this treasure is not hidden in a napkin or buried in a field, but he entrusted it to be healthfully dispensed through Blessed Peter, bearer of heaven's keys, and his successors as vicars on earth to the faithful for fitting and reasonable causes, now for total, now for partial remission of the temporal punishment of sins, and to this heap of treasure, the merits of the Blessed Mother of God and of all the elect, from the first just man to the last, are known to have supplied their increment. Now, I know the wording of that is a little bit old, but if I could just translate the concept for you, the idea here is that the Pope has heaven's keys, and he owns the keys to the treasury where the merit of Jesus, where the merit of Mary, where the merit of the saints is kept, and he can open up that treasury and dispense it as he will. If the Pope wishes to free a soul from purgatory, Roman Catholic theology says he can do it. He has the keys. And in 1476, it was declared, officially declared, these things are often existing in Roman Catholic practice long before they're existing as official decrees. In 1476, it was decreed that indulgences could be granted to the dead to help release a soul from purgatory. So this belief in purgatory did a lot to shape the thinking of Europe in preparation for Martin Luther's Reformation. That was really the flashpoint of the Reformation, was Luther's dispute over the practice of selling indulgences to free souls from purgatory. Let's move on from talking about purgatory and speak about how the Bible was brought to Christians who were non-readers, which was most Christians in this period of church history. Almost all Christians in this later medieval period were illiterate. Now, I would make a contrast between the first several centuries of Christianity, where I think that literacy was far more widespread. It was nothing like modern standards of literacy. But of course, in the first few centuries, we have good reason to believe that not only there was much more literacy, but manuscripts, handwritten, of course, were more commonly distributed among people. But there's no doubt that by this late medieval period, almost all Christians were illiterate, but they learned something of the Bible in many different ways. Some of them through illuminated manuscripts, manuscripts that were beautifully decorated, and you didn't have to be able to read the manuscript to be able to gain something from it. Although I should say that it would be rare for a common everyday Christian to even see such a glorious illuminated manuscript. I'm reminded of the fact that even after the invention of printing in the early 15th century, that Martin Luther, now again, we're talking about Reformation time, so this would be in the very early 1500s. I'm just using him as an example. Martin Luther never even saw a Bible until he went to university. So you're talking about his late teens, early 20s. I'm not saying he never possessed a Bible or read a Bible. I'm saying he never even saw a Bible until that time. That was common. And of course, in the centuries prior to the early 16th century, that was sort of when Martin Luther was an adult, it was even less common for Christians to have any access to the scriptures. But they could theoretically see an illuminated manuscript that taught not only from the words on the page, but from the drawings on the page. There were dramas, there were works of art like stained glass, paintings, sculptures, and of course, there was the preached word. So let's just talk about for a bit how the Bible came to non-readers in this late medieval period. And one of the ways was through simply what we call the mystery play. Mystery plays began as short dramas that presented biblical topics, oftentimes during Easter. For example, there was something that they called the Creed play, and it was divided into 12 different pageants, each of which dramatized a phrase from the Nicene Creed. For example, in the phrase about the forgiveness of sins, was illustrated by the story of the woman taken in adultery, and it was acted out in a dramatic way. These mini plays became longer and more popular, especially as they started to use the local languages instead of Latin. They became popular enough that they were moved to the church steps and the church yard. Eventually, they were performed by theater associations, by lay brotherhoods, and even by entire towns. They could draw the subjects for these medieval plays from Old and New Testaments, from creation, Adam and Eve, the murder of Cain and Abel, the flood. That was a very well-known play in England. But most of them were grouped about the life of Jesus Christ, his passion, his resurrection, even his ascension. These plays generally kept close to what the Bible said, but of course they would elaborate on scenes. Some plays were organized into cycles. They became so elaborate that they would be a series of 25 to 50 productions. In France, there was a single play known as the Acts of the Apostles that included 494 speaking parts and 61,000, almost 62,000 lines of rhyming verses. That play, The Act of the Apostles, took 40 days to perform. So this was obviously a way that would be very impressive to a medieval audience. These miracle plays as well would depict the lives of saints, some biblical subjects, some in church history after Bible times. So the morality play, the plays, these dramatic productions, that would be one way that Christians in the medieval period would learn something of the Word of God. A second way would be included under stained glass. You know, the techniques of building cathedrals developed to the point where making large windows was possible. And over time, the art of stained glass became an important way to represent biblical characters, scenes, and teachings. If someone ever has the opportunity to visit a great cathedral, especially in Europe, it is fascinating to look at the stained glass and look at the biblical scenes and figures and stories that are pictured there. Of course, they did a lot as well with ivory, metal, cloth. They would carve in wood or ivory. Metalwork was another important medium that was used. There are bronze doors, for example, at the cathedral at Monreale, Sicily. These were installed in the year 1186, and they have panels showing the biblical episodes, such as Abraham's sacrifice, the murder of Abel, Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. Again, artwork was like this, was ways that people learned biblical concepts even without being able to read. You also have examples of textile work from a place called Angers in France. There's a set of seven tapestries representing scenes from the Book of Revelation. There's scenes of the harlot Babylon riding a seven-headed beast. There's all sorts of other tapestries in this collection. These were made by master weavers, a particular one named Nicolas Batillier, in the late 1200s. Again, this would communicate biblical ideas. Then, of course, we have sculpture. During the Middle Ages, sculptors often did their work at the entrance of churches or cathedrals. Over the main doorways of many Gothic cathedrals, there are biblical characters as kings or prophets, and they'll appear on either side of the doors. They would have scenes such as the judgment of Christ, the division of the sheep and goats, whatever it would be. These were ways that the Bible and its truths were communicated. But of course, maybe the greatest way that biblical truth was put out was through preachers and readers. There's a very interesting example of this from a woman in 14th century England. Marjorie Kemp was born in 1373 in England. She was the daughter of a respected merchant and public official. She married a merchant named John Kemp, with whom she had 14 children. She died sometime after 1433. Now, Marjorie was illiterate, which is interesting because this depiction, you can decide whether it's supposed to be a depiction of Marjorie or not. She's listed writing. Marjorie did not know how to write. She was illiterate. But she gained religious knowledge from, well, number one, readers. In her autobiography, she said that she hired people or arranged for people to read to her many books of the Bible, theologians' commentaries, books that were popular at the time, such as the Revelations of St. Bridget of Sweden or The Scale of Perfection by Walter Hilton. So she would hire people to read books to her. But Marjorie's main source of understanding the Word of God and the Gospel was, as you would expect, through preachers and preachers. She loved listening to sermons. And in the late Middle Ages, there was more and more of a demand for preaching and good preaching that spoke to the people's lives. So again, Christians in the Middle Ages had something of the Bible, even though most of them were illiterate, but they would learn about the events, the characters, and the teachings of the Bible through preachers, through readers, through plays that they would watch, dramas, through artwork that they would see. In many different ways, they would learn about the Bible, though I would say in a very imperfect, sort of insufficient way. Now, coming back to this woman, Marjorie Kemp, who was born in 14th century England, she's also an example of a next point I want to make as a part of late medieval Christian life, and that's the pilgrimage. Marjorie Kemp was a tireless pilgrim. Now, she began her pilgrimages in a modest way by visiting with her husband local shrines in England. But in one very amazing effort, she left her family behind and she visited Assisi. That's where Francis of Assisi came from, of course. Assisi, Rome, Jerusalem, and Compostela in Spain in a single 3-year period. Then, after that, she went to different shrines in Norway, Prussia, and in Aachen. That was Charlemagne's capital. Now, why would a woman like Marjorie Kemp invest so much time and intention in pilgrimage? Well, a pilgrimage was considered to be payment for sins. It was like fasting or giving money because it required a great sacrifice of time and money. And pilgrimage was also dangerous. There were many pilgrims who died of disease or shipwrecks or at the hands of robbers. Some were even captured and made slaves. But to the medieval pilgrim, the risks were worth the reward of the forgiveness of sins and renewed faith. Now, for a while, I lived in Germany, not very far from the great city of Köln or Cologne, and there's a great cathedral in Cologne. The Köln Dome is what they call it. And at that great cathedral in the city of Cologne, there is at the altar, this is making me wish I had prepared slides on this, I'm speaking this spontaneously. At the altar at this Roman Catholic church, this cathedral in Cologne, there are supposed to be the three skulls of the wise men. Now, the Bible never says there were three wise men. It certainly doesn't give us their names, but there's the names attached to them. I think it's Melchior, Balthazar, Caspar. And supposedly, I think this is all legend and not fact, the skulls of the three wise men are there. Now, they arranged the placement of those skulls on the altar so that pilgrims could walk in sort of a U shape around them and see them to accommodate the hundreds, if not thousands, of pilgrims who came to see these skulls when they were on display. And I remember when I was taking a tour of that cathedral once, I've been there several times. It wasn't very far from where we lived. But in going to that cathedral and hearing the tour guide talk about this, just being struck with how amazing it was that there were hundreds or not, if not thousands of pilgrims that would come to visit these relics over many hundreds of years. And you say, well, what's the draw? What's so great? Well, time off of purgatory. The forgiveness of sins. These things were granted to, in Roman Catholic theology, those who visited these supposed relics of saints and people connected with the Bible. Okay, let's move on to our next topic. A little bit of an unpleasant topic in some ways. I want to speak to you about a movement or a people that is sometimes called the flagellants. You see, when bubonic plague was sweeping Europe, there arose a lay movement that was concerned with holiness, purification, and preparing the Christian community to face the judgment of God. Now, sadly, this movement quickly, we would say those are good things, right? Holiness, good thing. Purification, good thing. being ready to face the judgment of God. All of those things are good. But this particular movement very quickly settled into unbiblical and what I would call ungodly practices. And they were, for the most part, branded as heretics. These people were known as the Flagellants. Now, variations of this sect could be traced back to the year 1259, beginning in Italy. But they spread across the European continent in impressive numbers in 1349, one of the years of the Great Black Death. Christendom was deeply shaken under the horrors of plague time. One third to one half of the population of Europe lay dead in what was evident to everybody as a searing judgment of God against a corrupt institutional church and society. The fear of God's judgment brought together a diverse group. In these groups of flagellants, there were bishops and lay people, there were princes and peasants, men and women, rich and poor. They all came together under this banner of the flagellants. They would wear sometimes white outer garments, sometimes with a bold red cross on the front and the back. They would wear caps with the same red cross, and they would march from city to city in great processions, singing hymns and other songs as they marched. And twice together, they would gather together in a church or a public square and endure what they called their daily discipline. First, a letter would be read. The letter was supposedly from an angel, and it was supposedly laid on the altar of St. Peter's in Jerusalem. That letter said that Jesus was angry at the world's wickedness and would soon bring judgment. But mercy was promised on the condition that these flagellants would gather and make pilgrimages of suffering that would last 33 and a half days, corresponding to the years of what was thought to be the years of Jesus's earthly ministry. They would then strip to the waist, fall on their knees or on their faces three times, and they would carry a whip with heavy pieces of iron, sharp iron embedded in the end, and they would whip themselves, striking in time with the rhythmic music of the hymns that they sang. They would use particular gestures to indicate what sins they had been addicted to. So the hard drinker would put a finger to his lips, the gambler would move his hands as if he was throwing dice and so forth. Blood was often seen flowing down the bodies of these zealous people. To give you a little idea of the songs they would sing, there's one song that a part of it could translate it from German, went like this. Now join us all who will repent. Let's flee the fiery heat of hell. Lucifer is a bad companion. Whom he grabs, he covers with tar. Let us flee away from him. Whosoever will through our penance go, let him restore that what he's taken away. Now, although they failed to secure much of a following in the British Islands, the fervor of the flagellants captured the imagination of much of the European continent. You know, they perceived that they were under the judgment of God in unmistakable power, especially through the plague. So Christians were compelled to respond to the actions of God. And they believed that God wanted the church to atone for its sin by these brutal acts of self-punishment. At their root, the flagellants were people who loved God. They took his judgment seriously, and they were obviously willing to undergo great sacrifice for the sake of God. But tragically, we would say, their zeal was not according to knowledge. It was vain. It was futile. You see, the flagellants were deceived in thinking that by their own suffering, they could somehow make up their debt to God. It's good to be sensitive to God's hand of judgment. It's good to be aware that we owe a great debt to God. But the flagellants worked their hardest to prove to God that they were worthy of his forgiveness because they were willing to suffer. Now again, it's good to be aware of our guilt before a holy God. But you can't address the pain of guilt and earn forgiveness by a process of self-atonement. Basically, you could say that the flagellants tried to do for themselves what Jesus Christ did for his people on the cross. He is our atonement. And if we believe that Jesus paid it all at the cross, there's nothing left over for us to pay for our sins by our own acts of self-atonement. Again, how many of these flagellants were sincere, how many of them were misguided, how many of them were just strange. Look, God alone knows, but we can know this, that Jesus paid it all for us, and our place is to believe and receive the atonement that Jesus Christ has provided, not that we might think we can earn through our own suffering. Well, that's it for this lecture. So pleased that you could join us, and I hope that you can join us again for one of our future lectures.